South Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 3:18 p.m. on Wednesday, March 16th. We are going to start off today with House Bill 363, Broadband Office Grants and Parity. This is the second hearing on the bill. And before we go to further discussion with the sponsor, we're going to do 10 minutes of invited testimony from the Rasmussen Foundation. So I think Mike Navarre, Anand Vadapalli, and Diane Kaplan are online. And I believe Mr. Navarre is first. Mr. Navarre, please proceed with your testimony.
Hi, this is Mike Navarre. I believe Diane is going to provide our testimony in the shortened hearing.
Okay, great. Please go ahead, Ms. Kaplan. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We appreciate this opportunity to appear before the House Labor and Commerce Committee on this important topic. Mike Navarre is a member of the Rasmussen Board of Directors. He is serving on a think tank of Alaska citizens that is looking at broadband issues, and we have shortened our presentation because you have a lot of business on your schedule, so thank you for that. And I'll ask Mike to close us out at the end of our discussion. Broadband impacts many of the areas that are important to Rasmussen Foundation's mission of promoting a better life for Alaskans. We want to see this effort succeed, and we are prepared to offer resources, both as a convener and a grant maker, to make sure it happens. Over the next 5 years, Rasmussen Foundation will have about $100 million of unrestricted revenue to invest in new opportunities in Alaska. Our board is in the midst of a strategic planning process to select some new areas of investment. And the first one that's been selected is broadband. And the reason is we feel that our goals around education, workforce development, virtually every area of life, in order for people to be members of the global world and participate as citizens, relies on broadband that is both accessible and affordable. And therefore, this is the most significant issue we see where we can make a difference
at 3:18 p.m. on Wednesday, March 16th.
Brief at ease.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Back on the record.
Thank you. Bringing people together, Mr. Chair, to discuss solutions has always been a core part of our grant-making philosophy. And as we researched how we could assist with broadband, we convened over 30 stakeholder groups, including tribal leaders, nonprofits, members of the telecom industry, members of the legislature, the administration, and prominent citizens. Some of these meetings have evolved into an advisory group, and actually three, one citizens, a telecom group, as well as a workforce development group. This is to assist with information and assisting with coordination. We are also prepared to assist this effort financially. Two immediate areas we could help relate to the setup of the state's broadband office and coordination between the state and tribes. Over the course of our conversations, some concern was expressed that the NTIA money designated for the setup of broadband offices may be delayed. And if this is the case, and given its crucial role, we are prepared to offer resources to the state or directly to start building the state broadband office. Additionally, we repeatedly heard that strong coordination between tribal broadband efforts and the state was desperately needed for Alaska to take full advantage of this opportunity. To that end, we could also support the cost of a coordinator position to assist with communication and coordination between the tribes who are eligible to receive broadband funds and the state of Alaska. On a targeted basis, the foundation can engage in grant making with particular emphasis on workforce development, technology training for organizations and residents, and possibly even support specific projects. For workforce development, it'll be important that Alaska both build a workforce that can install, maintain, and service broadband infrastructure, provide training and resources to allow Alaskans, particularly those in rural Alaska, to access jobs that can be done remotely. This is a one-time opportunity for our rural residents. We are prepared to support both. The foundation is also building up its own resources in preparation for assisting applicants. Based on needs expressed during our stakeholder interviews, the foundation has identified organizations that can provide technical assistance like engineering and regulatory support, along with grant writers to assist with applications, particularly for tribal partners. We realize this is all coming together very quickly, and perhaps greater needs will emerge, for instance, assistance with required mapping. Please know that we are invested in seeing affordable and high-speed broadband deployments succeed in Alaska. We are open to discussions on how that happens. I'd like to call on Anand Vadapalli. He is our chief consultant who is working on determining if there is a proper role for Rasmussen, presented to our board, which has just allocated $3 million of startup funds for this effort on the part of the foundation to be deployed in the way most useful to the state. Anand?
Hello, Diane. Thank you, and I thank the committee for giving us the opportunity to speak to you today. I'll very quickly highlight two key takeaways for the committee regarding establishing the state's broadband office. The funding decisions under these various federal funding programs will extend into 2023, and deployment of the infrastructure thereof will extend for a further 4 years. So first and foremost, I would urge the state of Alaska to take a long-term perspective in setting forth the structure, governance, charter, and organization of this broadband office to ensure policy and operational continuity that will span changes in both legislature and administration over the life of these programs. Strong and shared leadership between the governor's office and the legislature is critical for good governance and long-term success. Second, as the eligible entity under the BEAD program, the state has significant responsibilities, including coordination, communication, planning, governance, and oversight. To adequately address these needs, the legislature must provide adequate resources and operating budget for this broadband office, funding both digital capacity and equity planning and grant-making and management capabilities. A well-resourced broadband office is critical in allowing Alaska to compete effectively for the funding available and subsequently to provide appropriate governance and oversight for the funding received. Our written comments will provide a lot more detail, including best practices from other states for the committee's reference. With these brief comments, I'll hand this back to Diane to close our remarks and open up for any Q&A.
And I'd like to ask our board member, Mike Navar, if you'd like to make a closing comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, committee members. I'm Mike Navar from Kenai, Alaska. I serve on the Rasmussen Foundation Board of Directors. Thank you for this opportunity. The Rasmussen Foundation has been tracking the broadband topic and multiple funding opportunities for a number of years. We recognize that we did not have the resources to build out the infrastructure, but if the opportunity presented itself, we would be interested in helping to coordinate and bring people together, convene them, and offer monetary resources in order to help achieve success. We're here to help you in any way that we can to make sure that this rollout, we see it as a once-in-a-generation opportunity to provide all Alaskans with critical infrastructure necessary to fully participate in the digital world. With that, we have had a couple of meetings at the Rasmussen Board, including a special meeting to specifically discuss this topic, and we want to help assure success in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Navar, Mr. Vadapalli, and Ms. Kaplan, and it sounds like you'll be submitting your full written testimony, too, so thank you for doing that. In addition to the invited testifiers, Christine O'Connor with the Alaska Telecom Association is online for questions. Michaela Fowler, with DCCED is in the room for questions, and the bill sponsor and his staff are here as well. Do members have questions for any of these folks before we move to amendments, of which we have many? Okay, moving to amendments.
All right, Chair, I move amendment number one.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
All right, the whole series of amendments that we're considering today were really done at the recommendation in response to the public testimony that we heard on the bill last week. One of the really important pieces was ensuring that we were adding tribal members to governments, that it, in the government-to-government relationship, tribes are governments as well. So we wanted to make sure to add tribes to this piece of legislation. That's what Amendment Number 1 seeks to do.
Thank you. Representative Edgeman, would you and your staff mind coming up, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Representative Edgeman, House District 37. I'm accompanied by my Chief of Staff, Henry LeLake. Total support of Amendment Number 1, just to get to the cuts of the chase.
Great. Then with that, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection to Amendment Number 1? Seeing none, Amendment 1 passes. Amendment Number 2, is there a motion?
I move Amendment Number 2.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Chair Fields. This amendment adds on line, or excuse me, page 4, line 18, following the word governor, inserting to 3-year terms, simply to specify the length of a term.
Thank you, Representative Snyder.
Just on the board. Thank you.
Representative Edgeman, what is your perspective on Amendment Number 2?
No objection to Amendment Number 2, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay. Are there further questions for the amendment sponsor? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair to Representative Snyder, what is the express purpose of 3 years specifically? Where did you come up with that?
It's not a specific rationale. This is just a typical range that you might find in advisory boards. Sometimes it's 2, sometimes it's 3, other times 4. 3 seemed like a reasonable selection.
Okay.
Brief at ease.
Yeah.
Brief at ease. Back on the record, Representative Snyder.
Sure. I move conceptual amendment number 1 to amendment number 2.
Seeing no objection, I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Can you describe it? Yeah, I will describe it now. It's correcting an error in the line. It should read line 19 as opposed to line 18.
Thank you. Having corrected the drafting of the amendment, I will remove my objection. So conceptual amendment number 1 to amendment number 2 passes. Returning to discussion on amendment number 2, I think Representative Nelson had asked about the terms and had his question answered. Representative Hardy.
Thank you, through the chair. So the office goes until 2030. So if it starts up, let's say this year, that's 8 years away.
Mm-hmm.
So you're doing a 3-year cycle with this idea. So 2 things. One is that the last of it's going to be a 2-year cycle, because that wraps up the last of that piece there. And why not make it, instead of 3 different pieces, to split it in half if that's going to be the case? And why not just keep it in a length of the term of the whole office that's going to expire anyways?
I think terms just in general, through the co-chair, having term lengths are valuable in the event that, there's a variety of reasons why you might not want someone to serve the entire time, the range of expertise that you might need, the dynamics on that particular board, the list goes on. I know we've all served on different boards and there's different rationale. If this was done in collaboration with the co-chairs and in consultation with the sponsors of the bill, and this is what we landed on, I was happy to follow through on that number.
Chair. Representative McCarty, follow up.
Yeah, so the question I have is, being on boards in life, the value of historical knowledge. And with this, it appears that you're going to lose all the historical knowledge because it's a 3-year term. It's not augmented in the process. And so 3 years, everybody's going to come off the board and you're going to lose all that knowledge and you start with a fresh board. And so how's that play out?
Representative Snyder, as I had looked at this amendment, I didn't assume that members would have to be bumped off, that those terms could just, they could be reappointed or renewed. Is that your understanding?
That is absolutely correct. So there's not a limit on the term being renewed. There's no language limiting that aspect.
Representative McCarry, I guess I would also just add that with the three-year term, the reappointment would come after the next governor, or the next governor after that had gained a little familiarity with this board, so maybe would allow a future governor to make an informed decision about who he or she might want on that board. So I think there's some benefit in terms of that staggering as well. Okay. Representative Strage.
Thank you. Through the chair, and I don't know if this came up previously in discussions on this bill, but I suppose there could be an opportunity for this advisory board to be extended beyond the 2030 sunset date if there were to be continued federal investment or the state decided to continue investing in this area. Is that your understanding as well?
No.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Shragi. Exactly. And whenever you look forward, you know, there's always an arbitrary nature really to we picked the 10-year term for the board itself because clearly it's going to have a lifespan of 5 years, maybe 10 years, depending on how long all of its work takes place. And that, you know, the three-year length of duration for board members, in my neck of the woods, the first thing that comes to my mind is the Board of Fisheries, and those are three-year terms. And board members, you know, at the three-year mark, or I guess after they serve their terms, you know, maybe apples and oranges in comparison, these two together, but a lot of them get reappointed if they're doing a great job and they've got broad supports and so forth. So it just seemed in concert with what the sponsor is recommending to be a pretty good period of time, 3 years.
Go ahead, Representative Strage.
Yeah, follow up a slightly different topic. So back to this amendment specifically and the terms, is there any word? I assume with a three-year term, the governor still has discretion to end that term early. Does the maker of the amendment have any insight into that? And is there any concern that we may be stuck with a bad actor or someone that isn't showing up to meetings or that sort of thing?
Sure. I think you can put on an endless amount of sideboards and guidelines on how a board should look and operate and be adjusted over time. I think trying to strike a balance between giving some direction, but also allowing some flexibility. And I think this falls within a moderate ground. And again, in consultation with the sponsor of the bill.
Go ahead, Representative. So the co-chair, Representative Shragi, again, generally appointees serve at the pleasure of the governor.
Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, I'll remove my objection to amendment number 2. Is there further objection? Seeing none, amendment number 2 passes. Moving on to amendment number 3.
All right, and move amendment number 3.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
All right, so the intention of amendment number 3 is to add 2 members of the legislature as ex officio members. That means non-voting members of the board. One would be appointed by the president of the Senate and the other one by the speaker of the House. And I think that we want to have good, close communication between this this group and the legislature in the event that we need to come back and there are either, you know, changes that we need to make to the Office of Broadband or there are appropriations that are needed to match. We want to make sure that the legislature sort of just well informed and engaged. They won't have the ability to vote and, you know, really change the direction that it's going. But yet, I think having those sitting members will be really helpful in terms of ensuring that the legislature is informed and engaged in the process.
Thank you. Representative Edgman, what is your perspective on this amendment?
Yeah, I'm a supporter of the amendment. I think it's a pretty standard practice, and it's a really good check and balance to have a member from each chamber sort of being able to attend the meetings, report back at large, you know, really be a conduit between the legislature and what's happening in the office and the board.
Thank you. Representative Draghi.
Yeah, so I support this. My only question is, with the change we made in amendment 2, I'm wondering if we should have a term on this one as well, or I'm curious to the amendment maker if you have a perspective on that.
That is a really great question. I mean, I would expect that these would be sitting legislators and not legislators that were termed off. And in the event that because of losing their seat. If somebody was no longer sitting in the legislature, they didn't get reelected, that their spot on the board would need to be filled again by the incoming Senate president or House Speaker.
Representative.
Yes, having done this before as a presiding officer, my assumption would be, of course, that if you look at what Representative Snyder's amendment addressed, it was page 4, line 19. That was for the 9 members appointed by the governor. The way I would see this happening is that the presiding officer at the start of each new legislative session, the 33rd legislature, for example, would appoint 2 members, and then the 34th session and 35th session and so on. There'd be no appointments. It could be the same legislator, theoretically.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Additional questions on Amendment 3? Not seeing any. Oh, Representative Kaufman.
Just a comment. I wanted to say if they're no longer in office, they can't be there. So I think that'll solve itself.
Yeah. Sure. Okay. With that, I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection to Amendment 3? Seeing none, Amendment 3 passes. Moving on to Amendment number 4.
All right, I move amendment number 4.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Once again, this amendment was crafted in partnership with the bill sponsor and in response to the public testimony that we heard, that they wanted to make sure that members of the un- and underserved communities were represented. We heard testimony that there are plenty members of un- and underserved communities that are, in fact, experts in these subject matters, and so they'd be able to add meaningfully to it, but I think it's really important to have those voices sitting at the table when those conversations are happening so that folks that are, perhaps don't live in those un- or underserved areas can be educated, particularly legislators, depending on who is sitting there. That voice is just really important. So, and then, of course, we clarified the definitions, and these are the definitions that are in the federal legislation.
Thank you. Representative Edgen.
In support of the amendment, I think it strengthens the bill. It sort of adds an additional this is what we intend to do, and it's in full alignment with the Federal Infrastructure Act and the Broadband Task Force recommendations.
Thank you. Further questions on Amendment number 4?
I do have a question.
Yes, Representative Cardi.
So Amendment 4, line 2, I mean page 2, line 31, it has the leading the number 1.
Page 2.
Sorry, repeat that question.
Amendment. Mm-hmm. Amendment number 4, page 2, line 31, delete number 1.
Uh-huh.
Ooh. What is that?
I think that could be a drafting error.
This is number 2, 3, so
yeah.
It's deleting just the number 1. It's not deleting anything else.
Right. Here, could we take a brief at ease?
Brief at ease.
Thanks.
Back on the record, Representative McCarty, you were asking about deleting the number 1 in it. It looks to me like just the number 1 no longer is necessary because subsequent sections are no longer numbered. So we're not actually deleting any content. We're just deleting a 1, a 2, and a 3. If I might ask the bill sponsor, is that your understanding?
If I may, just also because essentially this amendment, in addition to adding the 2 members who live in un- or underserved areas, we're sort of reorganizing the way that the bill is drafted, and we're moving these definitions of un- and underserved to a section further down in the bill. Therefore, it removes the requirement that we have numbers 1, 2, and 3 from page 2, starting at the bottom, moving on to page 3. So they're conforming changes reflected in the reorganization that's posed by this bill or this amendment. Thank you.
Okay. Representative McCarty.
So I'm seeing the flow of this. So page, this whole section is defining the words anchor institution and what it means in regards to bandwidth and unserved and underserved. So I understand you're saying we're deleting this and the definitions thereof, and it's somewhere else.
Representative McCarty, it's literally only deleting the number one. It's not actually deleting the text around anchor institutions. Because when you look at that section, starting on line 31 of page 2, we're not numbering 1, 2, 3, anchor institution, unserved area, underserved area. You're deleting unserved and underserved and defining them somewhere else. Therefore, anchor institution is on its own. Because it's on its own, it doesn't need number 1 in front of it because there's not a 2 and 3 to follow it. It's purely organizational, and we're not changing the substance of anchor institution.
Okay.
Okay. Are there further questions on amendment number 4? Not seeing any, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection to amendment number 4? Not seeing any, amendment 4 passes. Moving on to amendment number 5.
I move amendment number 5.
All object for purposes of discussion.
All right.
I move a conceptual amendment to amendment number 5.
And I'll object to the conceptual amendment for purposes of discussion.
I think we need that to be distributed, the conceptual amendment.
The conceptual amendment is being distributed now.
I think if through the chair, if nothing else, I get an award for simplicity in this one finally. So,
So I think, let's, Representative Kaufman, please describe your conceptual amendment.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Through the chair, is on page 1, line 6, following the word service, it's simply to insert and manage and deliver projects, with the idea of it being just to make sure that we have not only technologically aware people, but also project aware people, that because we really want good project management awareness.
Right.
Okay, Representative Spanholz.
Yeah, and I worked with Representative Kaufman on this amendment. We actually had two separate amendments, both of which did achieve the underlying objective of amendment number 5. And essentially what we're doing is we're consolidating our two amendments into one amendment by adopting a conceptual amendment number 1 to amendment number 5. So I support it.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Representative Eshman, do you have comments on the conceptual amendment to amendment 5?
Yeah, it appears to be a friendly amendment, so no objection.
Okay. Further questions on the conceptual amendment to amendment 5? If not, I'll withdraw my objection to the conceptual amendment. Is there further objection to the conceptual amendment? Seeing none, Representative Kaufman's conceptual amendment number 1 to amendment 5 passes, returning to the underlying amendment number 5. Representative Spanholz, do you wish to describe this?
So amendment number 5, as amended, essentially establishes a technical working group, which would be, in essence, a subcommittee of the board itself. The idea was to sort of mirror in the board what we saw in the task force, which was a technical subcommittee that included experts and subject matter experts in broadband and internet access in rural Alaska, and now also in project management associated with these broadband projects. We wanted to make sure that the board itself stayed broad, that it was technology neutral, but we wanted to make sure we were capitalizing on all the expertise that's out there, and that this technical working group would be able to provide information to the full board. The broadband industry representative on the advisory board will serve on the broadband technical working group, and then there will be, clearly, ideally, that person would be the representative to the board as a whole and sort of represent the working group to the broader advisory board.
Thank you. Representative Edgman.
Yeah, I'd like to speak in support of the amendment. Clearly, when you put an advisory board together, as the bill proposes to do, you want to be, cognizant of not making the board too big, but at the same time, you want it to be able to serve the function of wrapping its arms around all the various players that are out there as best as you can. Clearly, industry is an integral part of all of this, and we need to have their expertise at the table. And having a technical subgroup seems to, you know, sort of accomplish both those objectives of having industry having a seat at the table, being an important part of the decision-making process, but at the same time not expanding the advisory board to a point where it gets too big, my term, and it gets really hard to have meetings, and you spend all your time chasing people down to have meetings.
Okay, thank you. Are there further questions on amendment number 5? Not seeing any, I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection to amendment number 5? Not seeing any, amendment number 5 passes. Moving on to amendment number 6.
I move amendment number 6.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
All right. Essentially, what amendment number 6 does is on line, page 2, line 25, is sort of further defines the workforce development in-state partners and says that these in-state workforce development partners should include the University of Alaska technical, vocational, or trade schools and apprenticeship programs. We want to just make sure that as we're working on building out this infrastructure, that we're also building our Alaskan capacity to be able to build and maintain the infrastructure that we're being built. We've seen examples in the past where we didn't have good enough workforce development efforts to align with capital projects. And as a result, some of those capital projects have not been maintained effectively. And I think this is a great way to get Alaskans jobs and make sure that we're maintaining and protecting the investment that comes with this effort.
Thank you. Representative Edgman.
Speaking in support of the amendments, again, I think this also comports with the Broadband Task Force's recommendations, so no objection.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Representative McCarty.
The question is the reading of this amendment is to state that the University of Alaska is the overseer of the workforce, technical, vocational, all this stuff. So where is it that if other industry type individuals, organizations want to be partnering into this, what is that availability for them to be a partner?
Representative McCarty, through the chair, the intention is not actually that the University of Alaska would have oversight of all of these areas, but that the University of Alaska is one of the stakeholders that would be involved in workforce development. It would also include technical, vocational, or trade schools. This could include high school level programs. It could include programs that are outside of both any, you know, public institution in the state of Alaska, and also apprenticeship programs, which we've heard a lot about in this committee and how important they are. So it's not to put the University of Alaska over other workforce development programs, but rather to include it in a list of program types that would be consulted in terms of workforce development. To address your question?
If that's the intent, I was just concerned about the wording. It seemed to imply that the University of Alaska is overseeing the technical, vocational, or trade schools and apprenticeship programs.
Absolutely not. It's just first in the list.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for that clarification. Are there further questions? Seeing none, I'll remove my objection to Amendment 6. Is there further objection? Seeing none, Amendment number 6 passes. Moving on to Amendment number 7.
I move amendment number 7.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
The intent of amendment number 7 is to page 1, following line 12, insert a new paragraph, and I'll read, develop short and long-term strategies for deploying affordable broadband to communities statewide based on the effects on consumer costs, the timeline for deployment, the breadth of coverage, sustainability of broadband without further subsidy, broadband reliability, speed, whether multiple technologies are necessary, technological neutrality, and preventing duplication of federal programs. Then there's a renumbering of paragraphs accordingly on line 10. And then on page 2, line 13, we also include the language supports short-term, long-term strategies under B2 of this section, with the intent being to have short-term and long-term strategies and be aligned on those around the other statement of intent.
Thank you. Representative Metron.
Well, I kind of have to take a deep breath on this. I know it's well-intentioned, and I think I know what it's attempting to accomplish. But my first reaction as I look at this in a little bit more detail, I have seen it before, but is to, the way the bill is presented to the committee, and as we've amended it, I think accomplishes the goals that we want to accomplish. I look at a lot of terms here, breadth of coverage, sustainability, the broadband, further subsidy, things like that. And my instinct is to feel that this takes us outside the scope of the broadband task force. You know, maybe there's going to be additional committees that this bill would go through. That might be something we'd consider later on. And I don't know if you want to ask Ms. O'Connor or anybody else online to comment on it, but that's my initial read.
I think that's a good idea. Ms. O'Connor, could you speak to amendment number 7 from Representative Kaufman? Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Through the co-chair, amendment 7 is quite detailed. It has several concepts that aren't defined here, but are not areas where the task force made recommendations. And it's also my concern, this is the first I'm seeing it here, is it could, several things. One, it could conflict with NTIA's detailed rules, which will be issued in the notice of further, notice of funding opportunity, which is due in mid-May, which I think we talked about a lot at the first hearing. The other is this could have unintended consequences on existing federal programs, which are supporting schools, telemedicine, a variety of the telecommunications ecosystem, if you will. I would be concerned particularly about unintended consequences here.
Okay. Do other members have additional questions for Representative Kaufman and the bill sponsor, Representative Hardy?
So for the sponsor, so what I'm hearing about this process is for the task force is to do these very things that you're suggesting this amendment. What is it that you're not hearing being done in the task force that this has to be addressed?
Through the co-chair to Representative McCarty, it was to really get clarity that we will operate on short and long-term strategic plans, and that will avoid some of the conflicts or problems that typically crop up when you do potentially overlapping work or work in an arena where there's not only technological selections to make, but also the compatibility of those. And so it's just to make it more explicit. Again, within the framework of a short-term and long-term strategy.
Okay, follow-up. And actually, this is for Christine O'Connor. The same question is, what are you seeing that's different in the language of the amendment that from the intent of the task force to do? It seems like the same things of that amendment.
Through the co-chair, Representative McCarty, I do see some duplication here in what's already in the bill language. Affordable broadband is addressed in both the task force and then throughout the NTIA, the IIJA. Sustainability without further subsidy is not something that the task force dove into, and I think that is a concept that needs to be carefully addressed with coordination from the federal agencies, and that interagency coordination is happening at the federal level. They have an interagency working group between the FCC, USDA, and NTIA, and again, there they are also looking at duplication of programs. The reason that's important to be addressed at those levels is you could easily have an unintended consequence of eliminating programs that are essential to our broadband infrastructure in the state. The task force did talk about reliability and speed, but those metrics are addressed elsewhere in the bill when you set the served and unserved metrics. So I don't see that this is adding to the bill, and in some areas it is well outside what the task force recommended.
Representative Sponholz.
Yeah, thank you. I think that the intention of the amendment is good and is noble, and you can see Representative Kaufman's sort of process management and quality improvement sort of lens, you know, coming out here in this particular amendment. And I'm always a big fan of doing things right. I do see a little bit of concern with the sustainability of broadband without further subsidy issue being in conflict with the bipartisan Infrastructure and Jobs Act bill specific stated objective of meeting first unserved communities and then underserved communities. And so, you know, just trying to, we're trying to thread the needle, and we had some really interesting testimony from the NTIA about it, where we tried to educate them about what rural means in Alaska and what unserved means in Alaska and how important this is. And we understand that access to broadband and, you know, high-speed internet is really, it's like a utility these days. You know, you can't have a business, you can't get healthcare, you can't get education without it at this point in time. And so, I worry that the amendment as drafted, while I think incredibly well-intended and I commend the intention behind it, could potentially put us in conflict with it. And I think that as you know, this is the kind of thing that we can come back potentially in, you know, the next year and sort of refine with the broadband advisory group and, you know, look at when we're looking at broadband 2.0, if there's any additional statutory changes we need to make, we could potentially look at incorporating elements of this at that time, once we have a really, you know, a more robust understanding of what the federal guidance is going to be and how the state of Alaska can comply with both, you know, the spirit and the letter of the law and regulation coming from the federal government.
Representative Kaufman.
Yes, thank you all for those comments. At this point, I will withdraw Amendment Number 7, but I'm thankful that we got the discussion out there. As folks know, I'm kind of relentless about well-managed project. And at this point, I concur with some of the points that were made, although I still think there's good stuff we could probably fit in now, but I'll defer that. And thank you again for the conversation.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Kaufman. We completed public testimony on this bill last week. Are there any additional questions or comments for the bill sponsor before we take action on this bill? Not seeing any. Representative Funnels.
All right. Thank you very much to Representative Edgman and his staff, Amory LaLake, for their work on this bill. This is a really important piece of the Bipartisan Infrastructure and Jobs Act that will be a real game changer for the state of Alaska. And this bill is an important sort of building block, I think, for us as we move forward. So I move House Bill 363, version 32LS1527/I. As amended from committee with individual recommendation and attached to this fiscal notes.
Seeing no objection, House Bill 363 passes from committee. We will take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork, and then we'll come right back to discuss a child care trust fund. At ease. back on the record in House Labor and Commerce. I also wanted to mention that as 363 passed from committee, I authorized LegLegal to make technical and conforming changes. Next up, we have an informational hearing on child care trust funds with invited testimony from Aaron Merchant with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation, Stephanie Berglund from Thread, Blue Scheibler from AEYC, Dan Butel from Growing Alaskan Leaders. So let's start with Mr. Merchant and the U.S. Chamber's research on the impact of inadequate child care in Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Merchant, for being here.
Thank you so much to the committee for the opportunity to speak. Again, my name is Aaron Merchant. I'm the Director of Early Childhood Education Policy and Programs at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation. This is a topic that means a lot to me personally and to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And so on the next slide is just a quick sort of rundown of what we'll be talking about over the next 5-6 minutes. And we'll talk a little bit about why the Chamber is so invested in child care. I'll discuss just a little bit about what the term untapped potential means, and then we'll dig a little bit deeper into Alaska specifically. But so when we talk about the Chamber and child care, it really started in 2017 when the Chamber Foundation released Workforce of Today, Workforce of Tomorrow, the business case for high quality child care. And essentially what this did was shift child care from sort of something that was vaguely acknowledged as important to the workforce into a priority that the Chamber really acknowledged was an essential component for a strong economy. And the two-generation workforce contribution is the way that we still approach child care. Child care strengthens local economies. It enables parents to work simultaneously, providing jobs, and it provides an entrepreneurship opportunity for small business owners within the child care industry. And high-quality child care is also an investment in America's future. And so it gets people to work today, and it makes sure that we have a qualified workforce for the future. And one other, on the next slide here, one other piece to our work on child care at the Chamber, in addition to advocating for policies at state and federal levels that enable a strong child care system to help our economy thrive, is helping businesses help themselves. And so we did put together a brief, this one is essential care for essential workers, but it's really applicable to any business. And we provide a sort of spectrum of options ranging from how to talk to your employees about their child care needs all the way to, let's say you want to build a child care center at the office. And so just wanted to plug that in case we have any business owners or friends of business owners in attendance today. But really what I want to focus on in this presentation is the untapped potential at state levels as a result of child care breakdowns. And so the background behind this is in the 5 states that I've got listed here, these states took it upon themselves to conduct reports to try and quantify the economic activity that is lost due to upheaval or breakdowns in their state and local child care systems. Those 5 states found that they lost over $1 billion a year due to child care breakdowns. And so in 2019, the Chamber of Commerce Foundation partnered with business communities and early childhood partners in Idaho, Iowa, Mississippi, and Pennsylvania. This first cohort of reports were released in February 2020. At the time, we did not know that that would be referred to as pre-pandemic, but it does provide us a snapshot of what the child care situation was before COVID-19. And even then, it was not great. In these states, they found economic losses between $479 million to $3.4 billion. That is a lot. And so in 2021, sort of in the midst of the pandemic, we did another round of reports in Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, Missouri, and Texas. And at the time, to be totally honest, we sort of thought it was post-pandemic because it was right before Omicron, but it still kind of provides a snapshot of the child care needs and how it sort of differed before the pandemic and during. And what those 2021 reports as a group tell us is that flexibility is in high demand. When given a list of options for what would help parents balance their dependent care responsibilities with their work responsibilities, parents ranked flexible working days as their most desired benefits. We also, and this is not a surprise, but we find that parents are struggling. Missing work or working at home with a child rose significantly in 2019 for obvious reasons. And we also found that advancement for many, especially women, has been put on hold. Folks are passing on promotions, leaving the workforce, dropping out of school, and oftentimes not returning to the workforce because of a lack of quality childcare options. Which brings us to Alaska. And so, as I mentioned, we felt very privileged to work with the Alaska Chamber of Commerce as well as several child care advocates within the state. And we examined the current child care landscape. And when I say current, I should say mid to late 2021. And since the height of the pandemic, Alaska's unemployment rate has slowly started to return to pre-pandemic levels. But as more Alaska residents return to the labor force, our survey showed that it's important that there are adequate and affordable options for child care. If parents are not able to return to work because of child care, that provides negative impacts on both households as well as the state economy. And so when we look at quantifying exactly what we mean by untapped potential, our report estimates how often parents are missing work or other educational opportunities because of insufficient child care. And with that information in hand, we model the financial impact to the Alaska economy and understand what are we leaving on the table because of a lack of quality, affordable child care. And the results highlight the challenges facing families with young children and clearly show the need for flexible access to care of all different kinds. And so in Alaska, we found that $165 million a year is the estimated annual loss due to these child care issues. And the way that we arrived at 165, where on the next slide here, we see that $152 million were lost due to absences and employee turnover. And so if a parent is absent, this presents a financial cost to both the employer and the parent. Parents may lose wages for time missed. Employers experience a loss of productivity as well as the financial cost of maybe paying overtime, maybe hiring new workers, paying temporary workers. And so when accounting for these issues, we estimated that the direct employer costs due specifically to absenteeism is upwards of $110 million in Alaska. And how we get from 152 to 165, $13 million in tax revenue was lost just due to child care breakdowns, again, based on our survey data. Now, digging a little bit deeper, this is not an equitable, so it's an issue for everyone, but it is not equitably distributed. We had nearly 75% of parents reporting missing work or school at least once in the 3 months before the survey. I have a 16-month-old, and so I would love to talk to those other 26% of parents who did not experience disruptions and learn their secrets. 39% experienced changes to their employment situation due to child care. And in the lowest income group surveyed, 61% experienced employment changes due to child care changes. And so, and the reason our last slide is a whole block of text is because this is the most important lesson that we have from these surveys. And it's that the most successful approach is to organize a diverse set of options that are flexible enough to meet the needs of individual families and account for specific community dynamics, but also not focusing on a silver bullet, but a range of offerings that focus on flexibility, access, affordability, and quality. We know that many parents, it's the ideal situation, the preferred situation to stay home with their children, especially at the youngest ages. And what we at the Chamber want is to make sure that folks who want and would prefer to stay home, that they have that option, but also for folks who want or have to join the workforce, they have that option. And so we don't want to see anyone forced out of the workforce or forced into the workforce. And so, again, we just really reiterate that it's a community situation, it's a state situation, and the more options we are able to provide parents and the more opportunities for different types of flexible, affordable, quality childcare, the better off all of us are. So I, again, thank you for your time. And if folks have a question or two, happy to answer them as best as I can.
Thank you very much for being here, Mr. Merchant. And I think committee members will have questions. First, I just wanted to contextualize why we're having a hearing today on the policy topic of child care trust funds. Last year, the committee advanced two bills to expand access to child care. One was a child care tax credit for employers. Another one, and that was House Bill 121. Another bill, House Bill 149, passed by the committee, would empower child care providers to have more of a direct influence over funds dispersed into the child care sector. These are generally federal funds dispersed by the state child care program office. That second bill, House Bill 149, will have a second hearing in House Finance on Friday. There will be an amendment offered to establish a child care trust fund, which would inject additional resources into the sector. So kind of consistent with this last slide, we have multiple policy options before the legislature that could improve access to child care. And the purpose today was to start educating members more about this option of a child care trust fund, given that there will be an amendment offered on a bill that potentially could be on the floor soon. So with that context, Representative Funnels.
All right, thank you. Thanks so much for your testimony today. I really appreciate it. It's great seeing, you know, child care be identified as a business issue. It has been for many years, and we've certainly looked at the economic impacts of child care in Alaska, the lack of it. And I can tell you personally, I chose not to have a third child because I honestly could not afford to pay for child care for a third child, despite the fact that I love children and I would have kept having them. So people make real world decisions based on the ability to afford child care or not afford child care. And I say that as somebody that's really privileged, you know, as a middle class person with a college degree and a higher earning potential than some of the lower income folks that you're talking about. So it's great seeing the chamber step up and take some leadership on this issue. It is a workforce issue. It is a business issue. Now, on an earlier slide, you described $13 million in annual lost tax revenue due to child care issues in Alaska. And in Alaska, we don't have either a statewide income or sales tax. And so I'm curious how you measured that.
Mr. Merchant, oh, there you go.
Yep, sorry, I was on mute there. Sorry, I closed a window that I did not mean to close. And so let me pull that up. And while I do that, if there's a second question, I'm happy to field it. Or give me just one moment to bring up my methodology tab. So it says here that even though Alaska does not collect state income or sales tax, there's an estimated personal tax burden of 4.3% for median income households, according to the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. And so through the forecasting model, it's estimated that Alaska loses around $13 million in taxes annually, again, due to that turnover and absenteeism. And if that does not provide a satisfactory answer, I can also reach out to our folks who, like I said, I'm a little bit more on the programs policy side, but our folks who are super deep in the weeds into the methodology and the numerology there, happy to connect, and they can break it down to an even finer.
Maybe you can sort of follow up in writing after the committee to the committee, and then we'll make sure that we distribute that just so everybody understands what the assumptions are. Thank you.
Okay.
Additional questions for Mr. Merchant? Okay, yes, Representative McCarty.
Thank you. To the chair, so this trust fund type thing for child care, is that then available for all child care facilities, even faith-based child care facilities?
Sorry, could you repeat that question, Representative Carter?
Okay, through the chair, can you hear me? Is he able to hear?
I think we might have an audio issue. Maybe we can return to that. I think we just have an audio issue, Representative McCarty, so let's just go to the next invited testifier and we can try and get that answered in writing maybe.
Okay, so there's no way to contact him and ask him the question.
Mr. Merchant, can you hear us right now?
Oh, I apologize. Was the question about the Alaska, the current piece of legislation, and does it apply to faith-based providers?
The faith-based.
There is a delay on my end. I apologize.
Yes. I think you got the question.
Okay. I would need to defer to someone who's actually the next presenter from Thread may have more information on that. I've got a lot of data specifically about sort of the overall impact that investment in childcare has on economic output, but on the specific piece of legislation, I would not be the best resource for that.
Let's, Representative McCarty, let's turn to Ms. Berglund with Thread about the balance of faith-based and non-faith-based providers within the childcare space, and then after that, we can address the specific legislation if you still have a question, okay? Thank you, Mr. Merchant, for being here today and for the Chamber's research and helping us understand the urgency of the issue. Next up in invited testimony is Stephanie Berglund from Thread.
Hello. Thank you to the Chair and members of the committee for the opportunity to share and testify today. My name is Stephanie Berglund, and I'm the CEO of Thread. And Thread is a childcare resource and referral organization. We're a 35-year-old private nonprofit, and we're working across the state to increase access to affordable and quality early care and education with a specific focus on childcare. I'm here today to support the creation of a childcare trust fund. Childcare is critical infrastructure in our state, and it's a sector allowing all other work to happen. Yet it's underfunded and a system needing more public investment. Investing public funding to support the sector is needed, especially at a time when we're recovering from the pandemic, supporting Alaskans getting back to work, and aiming to grow a stronger Alaska. It's time we start treating childcare as a vital part of our economy, and now is the time and opportunity to do just that. Childcare was in crisis prior to COVID-19, and unfortunately, over the last 2 years, we've seen the sector get even more fragile. Access to quality childcare was out of reach for too many families before and has only been exacerbated. It continues to be unaffordable for many families, and childcare programs are facing staff shortages and struggling to recover from COVID shutdowns. We need bold policies to support working families and childcare programs, and a childcare trust fund is the first step toward investing in this critical infrastructure now and for years to come. We often talk about three pillars needed for a strong childcare sector: access, affordability, and quality. Access is the supply of childcare needed to support families with the care they want and need. In the 2020 Early Care and Learning Economic Impact Report, families reported access to childcare is getting more difficult across Alaska in order to get to work, school, and training. We know that's gotten even worse during COVID, as many programs are serving fewer children and are mitigating COVID following CDC guidelines, which still require at times multi-day closures and quarantines for our youngest Alaskans. Thread is monitoring the demand for childcare and how the changes in how we work impact supply needs. But we know that as families have been returning to work and school, there is and will always be a high demand for childcare across the state. With reduced access to childcare, we're seeing slower economic growth, and this impacts both our state's recovery from COVID and long-term opportunity and growth. A reduced labor force with slow economic growth is bad for all of us, whether we have children or not. This past fall, as you just heard Aaron report, we were excited to partner with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation and the State Chamber of Commerce to survey and better understand the intersection of business and childcare during the pandemic. As you heard Aaron report, that 75% of parents reported that they were missing work due to childcare issues, and others were postponing higher education and training. These interruptions lead to a loss of productivity and a lower sense of satisfaction at work, and stopping or delaying higher education and training decreases one's earning potential over time. I think we can all agree that the $165 million of a loss to our economy is just unacceptable, and we need to turn that around. Access isn't the only issue of childcare. The cost is simply unaffordable for most families. In 2019, families were paying 17% of their household income on childcare. For single parents, they're paying much more. And for families with two children, the average payment for childcare was their family's largest expense, exceeding their housing costs. The price for childcare in 2020 was an average of $12,000 for infants and $9,000 for preschoolers annually. Childcare in Alaska costs more than college tuition at a time when parents are at the beginning of their careers. During COVID, we saw a shift in families leaving employment, loss of employment, or having reduced hours, which made childcare even more unaffordable. While parents can't afford to pay any more for quality childcare, childcare businesses are barely making ends meet when they're relying on family tuition alone. This is why more public-private investment is needed. Childcare programs have struggled during the pandemic. Licensed childcare programs, who are all small businesses, were already fragile prior to the pandemic and are even more now. Their operating costs have increased at the same time their revenue has decreased from fewer children in care. While most of the programs across the state are open, which is a really positive thing, they're unable to serve more children due to a workforce shortage, which is difficult to fill, with high competition for workers right now, low wages, and few benefit offerings. The childcare workforce is in crisis. In addition to the low pay and no benefits, there is a lack of respect for childcare professionals, who are often referred to as babysitters. Instead, childcare professionals are responsible for preparing our youngest children for school and beyond. They're building key foundations of young children's development, including their early education, such as early literacy, and their social-emotional development. Their pay does not reflect their important work, and COVID has put a huge strain on the childcare workforce as they're caring for others while risking their own health, often without health insurance. This important workforce needs respect and the compensation it deserves. So it's no secret that the number one indicator of quality in a childcare program is the teacher. So as you can imagine, our teachers right now are exhausted, and as I just stated, they are doing hard work for low pay. This combination leads to teacher stress, and that results in high turnover and really poor continuity of care for our young children. Quality childcare is a licensed and regulated support that encourages stronger families and has demonstrated short and long-term benefits for young children. And that includes stronger language development, higher high school graduation rates, and increased long-term health. These positive outcomes support children getting a stronger start. They save us all money in the short and long term, and many of the social ill wills we're tackling today can be prevented and avoided. Unfortunately, many of our poorest families are not able to access quality childcare, and yet studies show children most in need benefit the most. Even fewer families have access to high-quality childcare, and that is those programs participating in Alaska's Quality Recognition and Improvement System, Learn and Grow. Currently, just 35% of eligible programs are participating in Learn and Grow. With more public investment, we could increase the number of programs participating, and we would see stronger outcomes with more access. When we support more programs following high-quality standards, we see that care and education is more developmentally appropriate. We have stronger childcare workforce supports. We have increased family engagement and curriculum-led instruction that's really tailored to meet the individual cognitive and social-emotional needs of all children. As you've heard, this is really a complex issue, and we need to find different ways to solve the childcare needs in Alaska. And while there's currently federal COVID relief earmarked to support childcare, it's short-term, and Thread believes it will not be enough to stabilize the sector. In December, 51% of childcare programs reported concern about needing to close in the next 6 to 12 months. If we already have an access problem, we cannot afford to lose more programs. Thread estimates that childcare needs an infusion of $10 million a month just to survive COVID, which childcare programs are still very steeped in. Access to affordable and quality childcare pre-COVID was already a struggle, and we don't only want to focus on getting the sector back to where it was. Instead, we need to strengthen childcare so that it is a thriving sector, one that's more sustainable and equitable. We see great potential for more public investment to strengthen and support childcare that will benefit all of Alaska. Now is our time for change, and we're super excited to see this idea to come forward THREAD supports the Child Care Trust Fund, which has the potential to address many of the challenges I just highlighted with a long-term view. Let's ensure long-term investment in the access to affordable and quality child care needed in our state. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Berglund. And I want to return to Representative McCarty's question. Representative McCarty, could you restate your question for Ms. Berglund?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, the question is, the trust fund proposal, would that avail faith-based child care programs?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative McCarty, for your question. My recommendation would be that any public-funded support be provided to licensed and regulated early care and education programs. So my recommendation would be, as long as those programs, regardless of type, were licensed or regulated through DHSS or through DEED, that they could be supported and have access to whatever the funds would provide.
Yes. Go ahead, Representative Carson.
So follow-up is that if it's tied to DEED, the Constitution doesn't allow for any state money to go to faith-based programs. So how does that affect this? And since child care has a strong element of education in the part of there, what are your thoughts?
Thank you for your question through the chair, Representative McCarty. It does get a little confusing, but we do still have many of our regulated early care and education programs through DEED, like our pre-K programs, our Head Start programs, are also childcare licensed. So I think it would be up to you all and those, you know, providing direction and details for this legislation to determine if there were specific boundaries or guidelines to that. But many of them are also small businesses and are participating in many of the child care supports already in existence.
Ms. Berglund, if I might ask a clarifying question. Aren't there faith-based child care programs that are licensed today in the state of Alaska?
Yes, there are, Representative Fields.
Okay, so just to finish answering Representative McCarty's question, the underlying legislation in finance and the trust fund idea would not discriminate against faith-based providers. It wouldn't change the underlying licensing regulations. They would be such funding would be open to them.
Go ahead. So it's I'm working through this, you know. So currently, no faith-based school can receive funding. And if this is under deed or given that, there's a separation of license. The facility may be licensed, but they're not getting state funding. But when they start getting funding, that puts in a whole different element where the Constitution does not allow that. What are your thoughts?
Ms. Berglund, maybe if you could clarify, to your knowledge, do faith-based child care providers currently receive subsidies for working-class parents who qualify for such subsidies, I think is the question.
Thank you to the Chair and Representative McCarty for your clarifying question. Yes, and I'm happy to provide more information for you, but I think there's all different types of child care programs, you know, that are licensed and regulated child care centers, homes, our pre-K programs or Head Start programs, many of them of faith-based, many of them have different philosophical education like Montessori or different types of programs. And as long as they are regulated and licensed through the state, many of them do participate and parents do receive subsidy and payment from the state of Alaska and through federal dollars through the Child Care and Development Fund. But I'm happy to provide more information if there's a specific question.
Let's
I'm
do
not
that.
Answering.
And
yeah.
Thank you, Ms. Berglund, for clarifying that. I think Representative Sponholz had a question too.
I don't have a question. I have a clarifying comment. The prohibition in the Constitution prohibits the use of public funds for public education, whereas child care is treated separately from public education and therefore licensed, licensed facilities like that are faith-based are eligible to get child care assistance. So a good example would be Congregation Beth Shalom has a licensed child care center that's also been accredited. It's a very well-respected program. It's clearly a faith-based program, set in a local Jewish synagogue in Anchorage. That would be one example. There are many of them. The prohibition is really focused in on K-12 education. It doesn't have anything to do with child care centers, which are treated and regulated very differently and not addressed specifically in the Alaska State Constitution.
Thank you, Representative Spanholz. Are there additional questions for Ms. Berglund? Thank you very much for being here, Ms. Berglund. Next up in invited testimony is Blue Scheibler with the Association for the Education of Young Children.
Hi, thanks for having me here today and for taking time to hear about this really important issue. My name is Blue Scheibler. I reside in Juneau, and I currently serve as the Executive Director of the Association for Education of Young Children in Southeast Alaska. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about more of the business side of childcare in Alaska. I owned a childcare business for over 20 years in Juneau, where I regularly operated on 1 to 2% profit margins if I was lucky. And I think it's those razor-thin profit margins that are really at the heart of why Alaska has had a deficit in the supply of childcare for decades. In Juneau, I can say that that shortage of childcare supply means that there's only enough licensed childcare for one out of every five kids who need it here. And related to that, we have data that shows that 68% of children under age five have all available parents in the workforce, but there's not enough care for their kids. So I think we see kids in unregulated childcare and potentially unsafe situations. Not all of them, but that is happening quite a bit. So I think the need for adequate supply of childcare is clear, but the business model for providing it is just not viable in our economy. And the conditions that make the childcare businesses infeasible are pretty simple. As stated by previous speakers, childcare businesses get their sole source of revenue from fees charged to parents, but that revenue does not cover operating costs. And even though that revenue doesn't cover operating costs, it can't be increased because parents are already paying more than twice of the recommended percent of income on childcare costs each month. So they can't afford to pay more, and programs can't afford to continue operating. That's the case that we see all across the state. And it's really the reason that we don't see growth in the industry and why we're going to continue to see supply shortages. There's a lot of national research, and we've seen this in our local region too, that shows that it's about an estimated $250 per child per month of additional revenue that's needed to cover the difference between the true cost of quality childcare and what parents can afford to pay. In Juneau, we have made a public investment into the childcare sector into a program that provides close to that monthly operating subsidy, and I've seen it make a huge difference. I've seen it keep businesses open, and I've seen it spur the development of new businesses. And so we hope that those investments are going to increase the supply of childcare and make it affordable and accessible for all who need it. And so I'm here to support the idea of this trust fund for childcare. Because I think public investment in the system is really critical right now, and it's going to help achieve many of the needs that were mentioned by previous speakers.
Thank you, Ms. Scheibler. Are there questions for Ms. Scheibler? I have a question that only having enough licensed spot for 20% of kids is an incredible statistic, and I do wonder if there are comparable statistics for the other regions of the state. I wouldn't expect you to have memorized them, but if such statistics exist, maybe you could get back to us.
I would be happy to do that. I don't know them off the top of my head, but Alaska as a whole has been called a childcare desert by Childcare Aware of America. So I would presume that the deficit is similar in other regions.
Thank you. Not seeing additional questions, thank you very much for giving us your time and expertise today. Next up in public testimony is Dan Butel with Growing Alaskans Leaders, Growing Alaska Leaders.
Thank you for having me. I am, as said, Dan Butel. I should mention for the record that I am a state employee, but I am testifying in a purely personal capacity here, not representing state or DNR where I work. And I have worked for the state for about 9 years. I really like my job, but I actually did just give notice in large part because of our child care situation. Is basically impossible. We are a family with two working parents with two little kids in preschool age and a baby. We're in Anchorage. And just wanted to talk a bit about how it's always hard to find care in Anchorage and very almost impossible to find care for a baby. Most of the programs start at 15 months old. And we're just always juggling kids and work, and then started looking at the numbers and realizing that if we have our two older kids in daycare and we hire someone to watch the baby at home, we're paying as much or more for childcare as my salary in post-tax dollars. So as an example of numbers, I would need to earn over $39,000 to cover having in a year to having two kids in daycare at $1,000 a month. Or we need to earn over $60,000 a year to have one baby at home with a caregiver full time at $18 an hour, which is the low end of the market rate for nannies, including employment taxes. So overall, to have two kids at daycare and a baby at home with a provider, need to earn approximately $100,000 to cover childcare costs. That's more than I make in a year, and it just doesn't make sense for me to keep working. And I'm at the point as a long-term state employee with a decent, reliable salary. The math is even worse for so many other people in lower paying or less stable jobs. I feel strongly that the cost of childcare shouldn't be driving anyone out of the workforce, but it is because it's unaffordable. And at the same time, we know that childcare workers aren't paid nearly enough. That's why there are a few programs running. It doesn't pay well. It's hard to make a profitable childcare program. This is flat out wrong, because childcare is incredibly important work, and childcare workers do an amazing job and work extremely hard. We expect the best people to take care of our children. They deserve to be paid way more than they are getting now. So right now we have unaffordable childcare rates on one hand and unsustainably low childcare wages on the other. This isn't a problem that will go away in a year or when the pandemic is over or when the economy picks up. This is a problem that will persist until someone fixes it. The solution is one that pretty much every other developed country in the world has adopted: government subsidies. We need government to recognize that childcare is important, so step up and fund it. Without affordable childcare, parents can't work. Without working parents, the economy just doesn't work. And fundamentally, without children, the future doesn't work. If you want people to take care of things like roads, healthcare, and the economy and technology 40, 50 years down the line, you need people to have kids. And people don't want to have kids if having kids bars them from the workforce and puts them in constant financial stress. The legislature right now has a unique opportunity to do something about this permanently right now. A revenue windfall from high oil prices. Take some of that money and use it to capitalize a child care trust fund, ask the permanent fund to manage it and grow it, and set up a system that uses the earnings to subsidize the child care system by encouraging new programs and building up ones that already exist. Talk to the providers about what they need, but start with increasing wages and benefits and making it easier to get money to start new programs. Our baby feels strongly about this too. By doing this, you can help get the price of childcare under control and improve the supply. Please don't waste this opportunity. Thank you again for your time and the opportunity for testifying, and for considering this important issue.
Thank you, Mr. Butel. Are there questions from Mr. Butel?
I have a question.
Representative McCarty.
Thank you, Butel, to the chair. Thank you for testifying. And hearing your child in the background reminds me of the challenge of child care. My wife and I had to make a decision of what to do, and at a certain point, one of us stopped working to take care of the children. I remember my daughter, who's now in her 30s and has her own children, taking her and the bassinet to my grad classes, and one of them was child development, and we got to watch her develop right in front of our eyes over the first 6 months of her life. What are you hearing from other people that are making that decision to stop working to take care of their children? What are you hearing from them in their mitigating the issues of their economy?
I think everyone has, you know, different situations. But, yeah, I mean, I've known several people who have effectively opted to stay home with their kids because it just isn't realistic to earn enough money to justify the cost of childcare. And that then reduces overall household income, and they're trying to make things work on one parent's salary, which, you know, fortunately works out for us, but that certainly is very tight for many people.
Mr. Butel, you mentioned that childcare is essentially unavailable for kids under 15 months old. I was hoping if Ms. Berglund or Ms. Scheibler are online, they could talk about how the childcare crunch is severe for toddlers, but it is even more of a crisis for babies. Could you address the economics of that from provider's perspective?
I could try to provide a little bit of perspective. So infant and toddler care costs more to provide because the ratio of caregiver to children has to be much higher. I'm sure a lot of people who are stay-at-home parents know that it's challenging to be home full-time with just one infant or toddler. But imagine what that looks like in a classroom setting where there are multiple children. So you really need a lot of caregivers in a room with infants and toddlers, and it gets really expensive to pay providers to do that. I think that's the main reason that it's so hard to find, and it is the reason that the subsidy program in Juno actually targets infant and toddler enrollments, and they get a higher operating subsidy at that age, because that statistic that I said of one spot for every five children in Juno, it's actually one for every 10 under 18 months. So our public investment here was really targeting that. And we did see a brand new child care center open that only serves infants and toddlers. And she was only able to do it because that per month operating subsidy made it possible.
Thank you. Do other members have questions for the invited testifiers before we go to a slideshow with additional information on other states' experience with child care trust funds? Representative McCarty.
Who just testified?
That was Blue Scheibler. Blue Scheibler with AEYC.
Okay. So I have a question for you through the chair. If you could tell me again what the ratio is, and the question I have with that is, if the ratio changed by one infant, would that help things out? And then I guess the follow-up with that is, like, who determines that ratio?
Thank you for that question. So currently there are federal requirements for what ratios have to be, and states must either meet or exceed those. In Alaska, the ratio for children under 19 months is one caregiver for every five children. And I can say, as an operator, I never had a ratio that was more than one adult for every three children, because if you have one adult for every five children under 19 months, the care starts to look not so great. It is nearly impossible for one provider to meet the needs of five infants in a classroom setting, and I've seen it firsthand. So changing the ratio in the opposite direction, I'm not even sure if it would be allowable under federal law, but it certainly would not be considered best practice.
Thank you. Thank you to the invited testifiers. Feel free to stay online if we're available. We're going to go to a presentation by Grace Kubitz and Tristan Walsh about just a brief overview on other states' experiences with child care trust funds.
Okay, for the record, my name is Grace Kubitz, staff to Representative Zach Field.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Fields.
So, wanted to say quickly thank you to the Children's Trust and Brooke Ivy. She helped with the research we put together on child care trust funds in other states. This is a very high-level overview, so we'll hopefully get through it in the next 10 minutes, and happy to take any questions and additional in addition to doing more research if the committee has any. So to start out, child care trust fund in New Mexico. In 2020, New Mexico passed HB 83 or SB 3, which established the Early Childhood Trust Fund. The program provides a stable funding source to augment both federal funds for services for children ages prenatal to 5 and the state's annual appropriations to the newly created Early Childhood Education and Care Department, or ECECD. This program will launch with a $320 million general fund appropriation, and in future years it will be supplemented by oil, gas, and federal mineral leasing revenues. Distributions from the fund will begin to support ECECD in fiscal year 2022. The bill passed unanimously on the Senate floor with a vote of 40-0. And you can see here, it was endorsed by many organizations in New Mexico. In Massachusetts, legislation was passed that grants the Department of Early Education and Care $500,000 to leverage state funding by working with philanthropic and private partners in order to assist both the business and technical needs of early education and care providers in the Commonwealth, especially related to recovering from the COVID-19 pandemic. The Early Education and Care Public-Private Trust Fund includes both money directly appropriated by the legislature in addition to gifts, grants, and donations, and it provides statewide and regional training in addition to making available opportunities for providers and stakeholders to assess and share best business practices relative to early education and care, especially regarding reopening efforts after the COVID-19 pandemic. Moving on to Nebraska's Early Childhood Education Endowment Fund, which they later called Sixpence. It was created in 2006 when major state agencies and private philanthropic organizations came together to create this endowment, providing sustainable funding for high-quality early learning opportunities targeting mostly Nebraska's youngest children at risk. The Board of Trustees for the endowment represents both public and private sector interests and awards the endowment's investment earnings to community-based early learning partnerships through a competitive grant process. The grant process is managed by Nebraska Children and Families Foundation, which also provides specialized guidance to promote program quality. Encouraged by Sixpence's success in improving children's school readiness, the legislature has twice now approved additional investments of public funds to extend its reach to more of Nebraska's youngest children statewide. And here are a couple additional programs that we won't go into more specifics about, just to say North Carolina's Children's Trust Fund was established in 1983, so it's been around for a while. Initially, it was financed by an annual state appropriation, a portion of marriage license fees, and interest income. A little over a decade ago, the NCCTF, North Carolina's Children's Trust Fund, equaled over $1.7 million. It suffered a huge loss because the state legislature used the fund to cover a state deficit. So the loss really hindered the fund's ability to provide grants and funding to agencies. But the trust fund responded to this loss by creating the Kids First license plate to provide revenue to augment services. In Oregon, during the 2019 legislative session, their legislature passed the Student Success Act. The Student Success Act invested $2 billion in education every 2 years, a large portion of which, around $200 million, went to the early learning account. And really at the heart of the Student Success Act is a commitment to improving access and opportunities for students who have been undereducated throughout or underserved throughout their education in K-12. Kansas received funds from the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement, of which 95% of the state's portion of the settlement agreement was dedicated to improving the health and well-being of children and youth in the state. So the Kansas Children's Cabinet is directed by state statute to undertake the responsibilities of including, which include advising the governor and the legislature regarding the use of money credited from the lawsuit to the Children's Initiatives Fund. Alabama Alabama's Children's First Trust Fund was initiated in the mid-90s and was similar to Kansas's, where it was funds that came from the result of a tobacco lawsuit. So the children's, once money comes to the CFTF, the Children's First Trust Fund, the fund is then divided among 12 agencies for specific programs as instructed by state law. And then a lot of this information was found on the Children's Trust Fund Alliance website, which offers a state-by-state look at many of the funds that we've discussed, in addition to national membership organization for these state children's trust funds. And yeah, that's it.
Thank you. Do members have additional questions for Ms. Kubitz, Mr. Walsh, or invited testifiers? Representative Cardi.
Thank you. I don't have this PowerPoint. I'd like to get a copy of it. Second is that these trust funds, I'd like to know what percentage that they are funding every year out of the corpus or whatever it may be that goes to, and what are the parameters of what is allocated out to, like who qualifies. You know, if you could give me the information, I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. Through the chair, Representative McCarty, absolutely. And, you know, it changes from fund to fund. And as you saw, some funds accept donations, especially, which is part of their funding. And many of the funds have boards that sort of go through an allocation process for grants, especially, but can definitely get you more information.
And Representative McCarty, I'm certainly learning about other states' experimentation with trust funds, but I think New Mexico's is most similar to what we're contemplating here. Or it's the closest, it's the most analogous.
If I could add, for the record, this is Tristan Walsh, Staff Representative Fields. Representative McCarty, through the chair, the New Mexico fund will be a 5% POMV draw from that initial capitalization of $320 million.
Representative Spanos.
Thank you. I think I just want to just clarify, too, for everybody who is watching and listening, that for some of these trust funds that are described, every state in the nation actually has a children's trust. Not all children's trust funds do the same things. And the state of Alaska has the Alaska Children's Trust, which was originally a state entity and is now segued off and spun off a few years back and is a private nonprofit entity. And it works to prevent child abuse and neglect. So if you're going out and you're doing research and you look at children's trusts across the country, they do lots of different things. And the ones that have been identified here have an element of funding or subsidizing childcare, not just sort of broader children's trust related work, which can, you know, cover a spectrum of services. Thanks.
Okay. Not seeing further questions, thanks everyone for participating in this hearing. As I mentioned, I think the Finance Committee will consider this topic on Friday on the underlying bill, House Bill 149. So appreciate getting the information before that hearing. Next up is Senate Bill 143, Common Interest Communities and Liens, from Senator Reback and his staff. This is the first hearing on Senate Bill 143. Looks like Ms. Torkelson is here. So please go ahead and describe the bill, and then we can hear from invited testimony.
Thank you, Chair Fields and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. Senator Reback sends his apologies. He's coming from the meeting, so he may be late. Senate Bill 143, this is Emma Torkelson for the record, if I didn't say that. SB 143 fixes two issues that have been causing significant problems for homeowners and condo owners associations for years. In 1986, the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act, or UKIWA, did an overhaul of HOA and COA association statute. The amendment process created by UKIWA requires that HOAs receive written consent from all loan holders before they can make amendments to their governing documents. HOAs have found this nearly impossible to get these written responses to their request for consent from the lien holders, so they're left with long, outdated rules that they can't change. Susan Jensen is online and is a manager of an HOA in Anchorage and can speak specifically to how this has been affecting her or how this has affected her association in the past. HB or SB 143 does not repeal the current process, but it codifies a process so that if HOAs provide the required notice to lien holders and do not receive a response within 60 days, the lien holder is considered to have approved it, and the association can proceed with the rest of the regular process to amend their bylaws or their governing documents. To clarify, SB 143 does not change anything about the requirement for HOAs to receive written consent from homeowners or any other requirement. It will just simply stop HOAs from being unable to change their documents if lien holders don't respond to their requests. Secondly, when a homeowner stops paying their dues or abandons their home, the HOAs created after 1986 can collect up to 6 months of unpaid dues from the primary lien holder. However, HOAs created before 1986 don't get that same right, and they just have to absorb the cost, often passing it directly along to the homeowners in the association. So this bill clarifies what's already in statute to assure that the approximately 150 pre-1986 or pre-UKIWA associations will also be able to collect their unpaid dues just like their post-1986 counterparts. This clarification will provide consistency with how these liens are handled for both pre- and post-1986. In closing, SB 143 will directly benefit all dues-paying home and condo owners associations and grant all associations, regardless of when they were formed, the same flexibility and rights. I'm happy to walk through a sectional analysis if you want, and then we have a couple invited testifiers who will give brief testimony if you'd like.
Sounds good. You can do the sectional now if you'd like.
Great. Okay, so Section 1 amends AS 3407 by adding a new section which lays out the alternative for common interest communities formed before Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act of 1986, or UKIWA, to obtain lien holder approval of the community's proposed changes to their governing documents. You'll notice that Section 3 inserts the exact same language into 3408 so that associations formed after UKIWA had the same ability. So we had to repeat the language, but it's the same in both sections, just for pre and then post 1986. Under Sections 1 and 3, both pre- and post-UKIWA communities who choose to use this alternative shall send lien holders a dated written notice and a copy of the proposed amendment by certified mail, return receipt requested. If the association complies with the written notice requirements and the lien holder does not respond within 60 days of the postmark of the notice, the lien holder is considered to have approved the proposed amendment. Again, this does not change any other requirements that must be met by the HOA. It's just for that written notice requirement or written consent requirement from the lien holders. Section 2 amends AS 3408 to clarify that communities formed before 1986 or UKIWA are granted what's called sewer priority lien status, or the ability to collect that 6 months of unpaid dues from the primary lien holder of the home in the same way that their post-UKIWA counterparts are currently granted under AS 3408 470B. So if you have any other questions, I'm happy to answer them. Or again, we have invited testimony.
Let's go to the invited testimony first, given that it's getting late. Ms. Badton, please proceed.
Thank you. Again, my name is Sarah Batten. I am an attorney at Birch Horton Bittner and Chereau, and I have been practicing community association law in Alaska for about 15 years. And I am very excited and am testifying in support of Senate Bill 143. This is much needed legislation for especially our older homeowners associations in Alaska. Basically, what I do is I help homeowners associations and condo associations enforce their governing documents and interpret their governing documents. And I can't tell you how many times over the years I have had condo associations and homeowners associations who want to amend their governing documents and have been unable to do so because of this onerous written requirement by the lien holders. And some of these associations even require 100% written consent from the lien holders. And you can imagine how burdensome that is when you have national banks that hold these liens, and they don't care, you know, if you're talking about a Wells Fargo who's headquartered in Chicago, they don't care about a little HOA in Chubiak, Alaska. So getting that written approval is almost impossible. And so what that means is these older associations are having to either violate their own governing documents in order to take some action, which, of course, I can never recommend, or they have to just govern under archaic rules, which is really unfair. So even for something so simple, like, for example, let's say that all the unit owners in the association would like the association to take over maintenance of mailboxes. So because currently the declaration requires that the unit owners themselves maintain their own mailbox, but for example, the association would like to upgrade the mailboxes and do it all under one project because of cost savings and having a consistent look and feel. And so everybody agrees that they want to do this. And instead of unit owners being responsible, they'll make the association responsible. But because of this requirement that any amendment be approved by the lien holder in writing, these associations cannot even make a simple change like that. So SB 143 solves this problem, and we are so excited. So hopefully this gets passed, and these associations can now move on with their lives under some new updated documents. And so we are very excited about that. And SB 143 also solves another major problem that we see, and that is these pre-1986 properties are continually getting financially struck with having to absorb costs that their post-1986 counterparts are not having to deal with because of this language that banks are saying invalidates the declaration, and so therefore they're refusing to pay the super priority lien on these pre-existing associations. And it's so unfortunate because it's these older associations that need this protection the most. They are the ones that have the older buildings that are most need of repair. They also tend to have more lower income people that are living in these buildings. And so it really is only fair that these older associations be given the same benefits that are granted to post-1986 properties, especially when you consider the fact that it's these mortgage lenders who are making the loans, and are, when an owner doesn't pay, the association is still contractually obligated to maintain and uphold the buildings and do the maintenance, like yard maintenance, snow removal, and which benefits the secured interest of that lien holder, right? So it's the associations that are maintaining their secured interest, and so it's only fair that they pay their fair share. And so we are very excited again to have this put these pre and post 1986 properties on the same footing. And so I am happy to answer any questions.
I share your excitement, Ms. Batten. Next up in invited testimony is Susan Jensen.
Hello, I'm Susan Jensen. For the past 18 years, I've been the operations manager of just one homeowner association in Anchorage, Alaska. Bayshore Owners Association has 454 private homes
and was founded in 1974. I concur with everything Sarah Batten has testified to. This bill has very important provisions for our association. Bayshore has wanted to amend its declarations many times over the years and has been unable to do so due to the burdensome requirement of bank approval in writing. A few examples highlight our issues. We could find ourselves in violation of our own governing documents when doing necessary maintenance projects. There's a provision that any expenditure over $20,000 requires a two-thirds approval of the members of the association, a hurdle in itself. But without bank approval, we can't even go forward with if we succeed. Our governing documents need to be amended to reflect the reality in our homeowner association today. One sad chapter many years ago during my tenure is we lost out on a $100,000 improvement that would have made it safer for children to walk to school using our green belts. A main roadway adjacent to our association was being redone, and we were offered at no cost to us a paved lighted pathway connecting that road through our green belt to three other roads and further green belts in the subdivision. However, we would have had to cede the property to the municipality. Without being able to amend our governing documents, it was impossible. And we lost out on that incredibly important opportunity. Lastly, we often stand to lose out on $1,000 owed to the association for dues, attorney fees, or maintenance on individual properties while their lenders pay nothing while waiting for the eventual sale or foreclosure of a home. This has added up in a few instances to more than $11,000. On individual properties, we had to sit on the debt and continue maintenance and stood to lose nearly all of it during foreclosure. There are numerous lenders that have lawyers who vigorously defend their right to pay nothing based on the Alaska law as it stands now or their interpretation of it. The bad debt gets passed on to innocent dues-paying owners. I would urge you to pass this bill to protect older associations by being able to amend our declaration and gain super priority liens. Are there any questions?
Thanks, Ms. Jensen. Do members have questions for Ms. Batten or Ms. Jensen? Not seeing any. We will hold the bill. Amendments are due Sunday at 3 p.m., and then we can hopefully take action on this bill next week. So thank you to Senator Reback's office and Ms. Batten and Ms. Jensen for describing the bill and the problem that it would fix. We don't have any other business, so... our next Labor and Commerce meeting is Friday, March 18th at 9 a.m. and at 5:12 we're adjourned.
I would.